Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Desperate times. The catastrophe in Sudan is deepening, and today Canada is promising more aid money. We'll ask the minister making that announcement how that funding might help and what Ottawa's doing to actually help end the conflict.
Ending a toxic relationship. A former official with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says it's fine for the feds to ban certain forever chemicals in drinking water, but in terms of the broader problem, it is a drop in the bucket.
The ultimate decision. A disability advocate in Quebec tells us about Normand Meunier, a man who felt he had no choice but to seek a medically assisted death because of a terrible condition he developed while waiting for basic treatment in hospital.
Commander in Kerchief, a real-life Rosie the Riveter who worked at a shipyard during the Second World War, celebrates her belated Congressional Gold Medal with a conversation that is appropriately riveting.
Stall tactics. Water reserves in Colombia have gotten so low that the mayor of Bogota is advising residents to take showers with the one they love, or maybe skip them altogether.
And these ears have heard a lot of songs, but they're never going to hear another one of that was written by him. Burton Cummings takes a dramatic step to prevent the new version of the Guess Who from playing his old songs. As it happens, the Friday edition, Radio That's Afraid, that cover band may never recover. Canada is promising more money for Sudan. In Toronto this afternoon, Ahmed Hussein, the Minister of International Development, announced more than $100 million to address the crisis caused by the country's year-long civil war, a crisis that is spilling into the surrounding region. Doctors Without Borders warns that every day, 13 children there are dying of malnutrition and related health conditions at just one single camp. And here in Canada, people continue to struggle to reunite with family members under a program created by Minister Hussein's government. We reached Ahmed Hussein, the Minister of International Development, in Toronto.
Minister Hussein, given the scale of this crisis, the depth of the suffering, which we've talked about on this program many times, what are you hoping this announcement, this money, will achieve?
Well, first of all, let's put this crisis into context. The dire humanitarian crisis in Sudan has resulted in the displacement of more than 6.5 million people within the country of Sudan. And then it has forced an additional 1.8 million Sudanese to flee to neighboring countries. Countries, for the most part, that are themselves struggling with humanitarian crisis, like South Sudan. So the people of Sudan are hurting today. They really need help, you know, humanitarian food and nutritional assistance.
Absolutely, sir. And sorry to interrupt. Our listeners have certainly become, unfortunately, all too familiar with all of those statistics as we've covered the story. Specifically, your announcement, though, how will it help?
It will help by, for example, enabling the World Food Program to provide food for displaced Sudanese. I spoke to the head of the World Food Program, Madam Cindy McCain, a few weeks ago, and she told me without additional humanitarian assistance for Sudan, the World Food Program will stop providing food rations to displaced Sudanese in the country of Chad. That's just one example. But the over $170 million that we provided to Sudan through trusted partners last year resulted in more lives being saved through the provision of emergency health services, food and nutrition assistance, protection services for particularly, gender-based violence survivors, and then shelter, water, and sanitation services. That's what this funding will enable us to continue to provide. And we're going through international trusted partners like UNICEF, like World Food Program, like the United Nations Population Fund, and others who are both inside Sudan and working in neighboring countries as well.
Canada's former ambassador to Sudan, Nicholas Coughlin, has written recently that Canada needs to sanction the economic networks that Sudan's warlords are relying on. What is your response to that suggestion? Why hasn't Canada done that?
Well, in the strongest possible terms, we do condemn the violence that's happening in Sudan, including sexual and gender-based violence. This must end. We must come together to support the Sudanese people. So part of the reason why I am going to this international conference next week on Sudan is not only to encourage others to provide assistance in the form of additional dollars, which Canada is setting an example in doing and we're stepping up, but we will also be at that meeting and beyond exploring together and discussing what other options can we put on the table to hold those who are responsible for human rights violations to be brought to justice.
Former Ambassador Coughlin also raises on the issue of humanitarian assistance. You know, he says that Canada needs to have a senior diplomat there in the region to, as he put it, gather intelligence on how Canada could best use its humanitarian and diplomatic heft. Is that something you're considering?
Well, the first step in doing that is to attend this international humanitarian conference dedicated to Sudan. I am very open and planning to go to the region very shortly so that, again, we're able to advocate for the protection of civilians, that we're able to meet with our international partners who are deploying and delivering the Canadian humanitarian assistance on the ground. These are trusted partners that we work with, and they have a very amazing track record of not just accountability, but impact.
Before we let you go, Minister, you know, I recognize immigration is not your portfolio, but you are clearly deeply involved in this file. And on the issue of the government program that was created to help people fleeing this war reunite with their families here in Canada, we've heard from family members, you know, a woman in Saskatchewan who said this program is, quote, impossible to navigate. Ashraf Al-Tahir was a guest on our show. He's from Toronto. He was trying to bring his parents to safety. We'll just play a little bit of what he told us.
So many people, they have fled with only their clothes on. They don't have documentation. They don't have enough papers, let alone the level of documentation required for IRCC immigration process. What we are trying with IRCC is to relax the requested documentation a little bit so that more people can leverage this opportunity and find a safe place.
Minister, what do you say to families and folks like Ashraf Al-Tahir who are desperate to reunite with their families? Some have lost loved ones there but can't make your government's program work.
I totally understand the concerns that have been expressed by community members, and I can tell you we are prioritizing the processing of completed temporary as well as permanent residence applications from individuals who are still inside Sudan and for those who have already fled, either with Canadian family members to the surrounding region or who have Canadian family connections here. I understand some of the challenges, including the fact that Canada no longer has a diplomatic presence inside Sudan due to the conflict. So there are some, of course, logistical challenges, but we are really doing everything that we can to overcome them. And part of the way we do that is to also utilize the strengths and knowledge of the Sudanese-Canadian community that still maintains those contacts and is very much present on the ground in Sudan. And so later this evening, I'll be meeting with those community members who actually helped us design this particular humanitarian pathway.
Has anyone landed in Canada so far? I just want to make sure we have up-to-date information.
I don't have the latest figures. You can appreciate I'm not the Minister of Immigration, but
sure.
I will be getting that update from community members, and I can tell you they're very happy with our collaborative approach with the community, and that's how you get the right program to work the way it's supposed to work on the ground.
Minister Hussein, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Ahmed Hussein is Canada's Minister of International Development. We reached him in Toronto. Normand Meunier chose to die, but members of his family and disability advocates say he should have had other choices. Mr. Meunier was a former truck driver whose arms and legs were paralyzed after a spinal cord injury in 2022. In its aftermath, he dealt with a recurring series of infections and hospitalizations, culminating in a January visit to the Saint-Jérôme ER outside Montreal for a respiratory virus. He spent nearly 4 days there before being transferred. And during that time, he developed a pressure wound that ultimately contributed to his decision to seek medical assistance in dying, which he did on March 29th. Now his partner, Sylvie Brosseau, and a Quebec Spinal Cord and Mobility Foundation are demanding a private investigation into his care. Ariane Gauthier-Tremblay is a community organizer with that foundation. We reached her in Quebec City.
Ariane, what have you heard about how Normand Meunier's family is doing now?
Presently, Madame Rousseau is very sad, but still she is very determined to make that story an occasion to shake the government and the health system to change, to have better health care for spinal cord injured people.
When they arrived at the Saint-Jérôme Hospital Emergency Room in January, they were very clear that they needed a special bed, an alternating pressure bed. What should have happened when they asked for that?
Well, as a spine cord injured person, Mr. Meunier has a very high vulnerability to pressure wounds. And that's why he insisted for that special bed. Mm-hmm. And if he would have received that special mattress, those wounds would have been avoided, and Mr. Meunier would be still alive and happy with his wife living his life.
Yeah. It's upsetting for you to hear what happened.
Yeah, we are very emotional about that. Hospitals must have those equipment, or at least an attendant to move him, to have a special attention to prevent those wounds.
Can you describe for our listeners the impact that this would have on someone with a spinal cord injury? Because this is different than just a regular wound or even a bed sore.
Yeah. For spinal cord injured people, fresh wounds would occur very rapidly. In a few hours, a little pressure between, you know, the sit bones or the tailbone and a mattress can turn into a blister. And, you know, within 24 hours, that blister can become an open wound that can deepen into the bone. And that's what happened to Mr. Meunier. And there is a systemic reaction that comes, like shaking and fever and bad sensation that says, something's wrong is going on. So that was the injury that was turning from blister to open wound to an infection up to the bone, you know.
Why do you think, Ariane, that even if there wasn't a bed, that they didn't listen to their concerns, according to the family? Why?
We acknowledge that the staff, you know, the emergency staff are not always well trained to attend spine cord injured persons. And we need specific teams that are specialized on preventing and attending pressure wounds. But, you know, first of all, when somebody arrives and says, I am spine cord injured and I need a mattress, they shouldn't be treated as an annoying patient, but as a knowing patient.
Knowing,
that
not
knows
annoying.
About his specific needs.
Let me ask you, have you ever heard of something like this before, Ariane?
Yes. We have dozens of members who suffer. Many of them develop pressure wounds at the emergency, many of them fear to go to the emergency because they fear to come out worse than how they arrived.
You had a colleague, as I understand it, who chose medically assisted death because of the inadequate home care he was receiving. Can you tell us what happened?
He was so painful, and the attendants was so badly realized that the problems would get worse and worse. You know, it's a spiral of problems that brought him down to ask for medical assisted death.
Yeah.
I'm kind of shaking up.
Oh, it's okay. It's emotional. It's emotional.
Yeah, really. Because we have been in touch with dozens and dozens of our members who are deprived of having just a normal life of somebody who is in wheelchair. You know, living in a wheelchair is livable, but a pressure wound is like hell.
I wonder, Ariane, let me ask you just finally before we have to let you go, how do you feel about the expanded access to medical assistance in dying when you are already concerned about the kind of care people in Canada are receiving?
It's an issue that concerns us very deeply. We understand and we will support people who will choose as an ultimate choice to, you know, have a little kind of power to choose how they will die. But we are very conscious on the fact that many of our members would choose medical assisted death because they don't have the cares they have the right to have. They would go for medical assisted death.
Ariane, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ariane Gauthier-Tremblay is a community organizer with MEMO, a Quebec foundation supporting Normand Meunier's family. The health authority that manages the Saint-Jérôme Hospital says an internal investigation is underway and that 145 alternating pressure mattresses are currently available across its facilities, albeit not in emergency rooms. On Wednesday in Washington, D.C., Rosie the Riveter's famous We Can Do It finally became We Did It. Nearly 80 years after their service, 27 Rosies, women who joined the wartime workforce during the Second World War, were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. Marianne Suzet worked in the engineering department of a shipyard during the war. We reached her in Washington, D.C.
Marianne, you all had to wait such a long time for this recognition. How did it feel to be there all together and to finally be recognized?
You know, I'm still searching for the perfect word. It's just so amazing, and I'm just so elated that they have finally recognized these courageous women that stepped forward.
I saw some of the photographs from the event. I saw all the red and the polka dots. I saw younger women as well. Just what was it like to sit there and take all of that in?
Well, I speak at the Rosie the Riveter Park every Friday, and so, you know, I'm used to this. but the polka dot thing, that was to identify us and to let everybody know that we were our Rosie the Riveters.
Yeah. You joined the wartime workforce. You were just 17 years old. What kind of work did you do?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I had an art class teacher that recommended me for a special class, at UC Berkeley. It was a six-week course in engineering drawing. And so I learned to draw blueprints and hired right out of that classroom to go to shipyard number 3 in the engineering department as a draftsman.
So when you walked into shipyard number 3, did you understand, I mean, cool to have a job so young, but did you understand how important the work you were doing was?
Like I said, I was only 17, yeah. And I knew that I was going to, this was my first job. That kind of feeling, that patriotic feeling I got from my dad, who was in the Army, and I was glad to help out. I wanted to do something, and, I had two sisters who became welders, and our mother became a spray painter. We all wanted to help.
That's incredible. You know, you said the title of your job, draftsman. It's in the name. It's certainly, yeah. It was a man's world in some ways, in some fields. I bet it still feels like that for a lot of people as well. Were the men welcoming? What was it like to work in that environment?
They were really kind. They never looked down on us. You know, we were doing elementary things. There was another room that had the master draftsman who had many years of training, and which I couldn't do. But they needed what I did, so, I actually, under instructions, I would erase parts of the architect's drawings and put in my own.
What about after the war? Were you able to continue the kind of work that you were doing?
No. In fact, I had married in high school. And so after a year, I was expecting my first baby. And those master draftsmen gave me a surprise baby shower.
What kind of baby shower do draftsmen throw? What kind of party do draftsmen throw?
Well, you know, that's many years ago, and I was so excited. It was typical. I had lots of gifts and those tiny little gift cards, and it was just a typical one.
Yeah, so. You had your hands
but,
full.
Well, you know, this was done on work time. Yeah. So, they had to get back to work.
Well, it's nice that they carved out a little bit of time to celebrate you. So after, you know, obviously you had your hands full, you had your first baby on the way, you were married. But did you ever miss that work over the years?
Oh, yes, I did. I certainly wish I missed the pay.
I bet. Yeah.
It was my first job. And we saved, had war bonds taken out of our checks, and everybody did something, even the little tiny stamps that you, everything was towards the war effort. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you volunteer at the Rosie the Riveter National Park. What do you tell the groups that come there?
Well, I tell them a little bit about Richmond and how this town that was only 23,000 bloomed into 100,000 and just overwhelmed things. And this little town of Richmond, California, people were working day shift, swing shift, and graveyard.
How do you feel about where women are today?
Well, they give us credit, and I can see that did happen. When we left San Francisco on the airplane, the people are united. They had all the women who were mechanics and machinists, and they were all dressed like Rosies with a scarf on their head. And it was just a great party and a great send-off showing the diversity that women can do now. Yeah. And we've been to an Air Force base, and all these mechanics so proud of their work. And if I did anything to help, I'm glad. I'm proud.
Oh, well, that makes me smile, Marian. I know you have grandchildren, a granddaughter, at least one granddaughter. What do they think about their Grandma Marian, a Rosie?
Well, it varies, but my granddaughters, yes, they're all pleased, and they're all working. Yes, different jobs. And it happened, but, we still don't have equal pay.
No, we don't, Marian. And I'll leave that last word to you. Thank you so much, Marian. A pleasure speaking with you. Congratulations.
Bye.
You take care.
Thank you.
Marian Suze is a Rosie who was honored in Washington, D.C. this week. That's where we reached her. Is this the Guess Who? Sort of. It's Chad Allen and the Expressions. But when they released this single in 1965, their label thought it would be cool to send it to radio stations under the name Guess Who? With a question mark, so those stations would think the song was by a cool British group and not a band from Winnipeg, yeah, to create mystique and money. This the Guess Who? Yes, they kept the name, they dropped the question mark, they replaced lead singer Chad Allen with Burton Cummings, and they had a string of hits in the late 60s and early 70s. I'm not going to name them because you know them all. But is this the Guess Who? Well, they call themselves the Guess Who, they tour as the Guess Who, and they play all the classics. They also play this song, which they released last November, as the Guess Who. But drummer Gary Peterson is the only original member still in the band, and he sometimes doesn't play, so the band that takes the stage as the Guess Who is just four guys playing Guess Who songs. Randy Bachman and Burton Cummings refer to that group as the cover band. And last year, they filed a lawsuit accusing this Guess Who of false advertising. And now, Mr. Cummings has gone scorched earth. He has terminated all the performance rights agreements for all the songs he wrote or co-wrote. And that means that if any band plays These Eyes, Laughing, Undone, No Time, or American Woman, among others, he can sue that band and the venue in which they played that song. He told Rolling Stone, "I'm willing to do anything to stop the fake band." As to whether it will work, well, that's anybody's guess who.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
When you pour yourself a glass of tap water, you might be pouring yourself a glass of so-called forever chemicals. So this week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced new limits on 6 PFAS, or per- and polyfluoroalkyl compounds, in drinking water. The chemicals are used to waterproof products or make them heat resistant, and as the forever part of their nickname suggests, they resist being naturally broken down. Kyla Bennett is a former EPA official who is now the Science Policy Director at Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. We reached her in Easton, Massachusetts.
Kyla, I know you don't think this new rule on PFAS in drinking water goes far enough. Why not?
Well, for one thing, there are over 14,000 PFAS, according to EPA, and this is regulation of 6 of them. Mm-hmm. So part of the problem is that this chemical-by-chemical whack-a-mole approach does not do anything to protect us. This is helpful. It's a good start. This is something that should have been done 20 years ago. But the fact remains that we are still being subject to massive quantities of these other PFAS that are not regulated at all.
Well, why do you think they're taking this, as you put it, whack-a-mole approach?
That's an interesting question. And I listened to Administrator Michael Regan's speech at the Society of Environmental Journalists last week, and somebody asked him that question. One of the reporters asked him why he wasn't doing a class-based regulation, and his answer was that he basically, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said that he fears the courts overturning him. They fear that they won't have the science, that they don't have the science for all of these compounds. But that's really a self-fulfilling prophecy there, because EPA knew that some of these PFAS were toxic back in the 1990s and did nothing. And while they started to do these volunteer phase outs of certain legacy PFAS, all that did was enable industry to make regrettable substitutions. In other words, they just tweaked the chemical formula and came out with other PFAS. So we have this really unusual situation here where there's this very large class of human-made chemicals, all of which are persistent. All of the ones we've tested have been toxic, and most of them bioaccumulate, and yet we don't have toxicity information on the vast majority of them.
What kinds of products currently do have PFAS in them that you want our listeners to know about and consider?
So many. Frying pans, makeup, guitar strings, tents, carpets, upholstered furniture, period underwear, artificial turf, firefighter gear. It's virtually everywhere. But the vast majority of these uses are convenience, not necessity. And what EPA needs to do is regulate them as a class and ban all non-essential uses.
How would a government go about banning all of them, as you would prefer they do? What's the mechanism they could use from where you stand?
EPA does have the authority to regulate chemicals as a class, and indeed they already do regulate some chemicals as a class. Nothing this large, but it certainly is legal, and it's certainly doable. So what they need to do is to first define PFAS. It's kind of frightening that EPA doesn't even have a consistent definition of what a PFAS is. So they need to define it. Then they need to regulate them as a class and say all chemicals that meet this definition have to be banned. They cannot be used unless they're an essential use. And there are some essential uses. For example, Paxlovid, the drug that we use to combat COVID-19, is a PFAS. Prozac is a PFAS. Flonase, which is an allergy medicine, that's a PFAS. So there are some essential uses, but all of the uses that are just for convenience should be eliminated.
There is also this argument, one lawyer in particular telling the Guardian newspaper that by limiting at least even some of these chemicals, it acknowledges their harm and might actually make it easier to sue PFAS polluters. Where do you sit with that argument?
I'm not sure that that's true. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many PFAS and because we have so little toxicity information on them, I think that that's not going to really happen. But what needs to happen is that these industries do need to get sued, frankly. They knew they were poisoning us, but they made the decision to continue manufacturing these chemicals and poisoning the world with them in order to make money. They put money and profits over the health of humans and the environment, and that's just wrong.
The Canadian government is being urged to do something similar and regulate these chemicals in our water specifically in Canada. What would you suggest to the Canadian government?
I would suggest that the Canadian government first use a good definition like the OECD definition, and second, that they should regulate them on a class-based, even if it's a smaller class, even if it's not all 14,000 of them, there are subclasses of these chemicals that can be regulated, which would go much farther to protecting Canadians from these toxic effects.
Kyla, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kyla Bennett is a former EPA official who is now the Science Policy Director at Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. She's in Easton, Massachusetts. Officials in Colombia's capital, Bogota, are urging residents to conserve water. Reservoirs that supply the area are low, which has prompted water rationing this week. It's happening in shifts, and millions of people are going to be affected. Inigo Alexander is one of them. He's a freelance journalist in Bogota. That's where we reached him.
Inigo, your city's mayor has made some requests to you and others in Bogota. What is he asking you all to do?
Well, he's introduced some water rationings, which came into effect Thursday this week, Thursday the 11th. So he's asked people in Bogota to try and be more conscious about their water use and cut back on their daily water consumption. And on top of that, he's also implemented a rationing across a number of different boroughs and neighborhoods across Bogota. So that's the main change that the residents here in Bogota have felt as of yesterday and will be dealing with for the next couple of weeks. It's a bit of an open timeline still.
Yeah. But, he got pretty specific with people, even saying, you know, hey, if you're not going to go out, maybe don't shower. Have you heard that instruction?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He sort of said, you know, if you're going to spend your weekend, your Sunday lounging around at home, not doing anything, not leaving the house, you know, don't feel obliged to shower. There's no need to have to keep up with personal hygiene, he said, if we're not really going to be doing much.
Are you going to take that advice?
Sure. Yeah, I buy
too personal a question, maybe
accidentally. So I'm happy to play my part.
Are people though taking this seriously? How are people there responding to this rationing system, these requests?
Yeah. Well, the first reaction was somewhat tongue in cheek. It was a bit. There was a lot of jokes about the matter, especially online. A lot of memes and a lot of tongue-in-cheek comments about the rationing that was coming into effect. Mainly, I think, because it didn't really come as a shock. There were rumors about it happening, and everyone was aware that it was a particularly dry season in Bogota and in Colombia. Mm-hmm. So there was knowledge of a shortage of water. So once the official rationing got announced last week, it didn't really come as a surprise, and it wasn't really presented as a doom and gloom sort of narrative. It was more so a pragmatic approach to an issue that most people were aware of and were conscious that was likely to happen.
And are people going to heed, you know, the requests and the rationing rules? Even, I mean, he even went further than saying don't take a shower if you're not going to go out. Couples should shower together, he said. Like, is he joking in that moment to try to get people on board, or is he serious?
He was serious. He was, you know, trying to encourage people to be more conscious and really take into consideration every drop of water they use. And one of the suggestions he made, albeit in a bit more of a joking tone, was, you know, if you're a couple, consider having a shower together instead of showering separately. And it remains to be seen if people will abide by it. I think there is a collective consciousness to try and do something about it, but there is also... It's very early days, so mm-hmm. people haven't really had their lives massively disrupted as of yet. Again, the first rationing of water was yesterday in some of the higher class neighborhoods. And, you know, you can argue that the higher class neighborhoods are the ones which are most prepared and ready to be able to deal mm-hmm. with a shortage of that kind. So it hasn't been massively disruptive as of yet, but I think there is an urgency as we get further into the rationing to abide by it, because otherwise the government said at the town hall in Bogota, has said that if collectively we don't abide by it, it could get prolonged for much longer, as it is quite a drastic situation.
I've seen some of the photographs of how parched the land is. Have you seen any of these reservoirs up close?
Yeah, I was up hiking in one of the national parks that is nearby Bogota a couple of weeks ago before these measures were introduced. And I was hiking in the national park, which also houses a number of the reservoirs which actually supply Bogota with around 70% of its water supply. And you could tell in, you know, some of the lakes and the water sources there, you could see that especially around the shore, there was a notable decrease of water. And, you know, a lot of the staff and the workers there did point out that it was particularly dry and it was... there was a bit of a shortage, and there was some lower levels in a lot of the water sources. But you know, the remaining scenery is still alive and lush. It's not mm-hmm. you know, dry, arid deserts or anything. But there is a significant and a very noticeable decrease in a lot of the water sources that's around Bogota.
Did you worry as you looked out?
Not initially, not to the degree that I thought that we would be having water rations now, as that was only a few weeks ago. But I mean, it was quite surprising and quite shocking to see, because it was a noticeable difference in the water levels. But I didn't realize that the rationing might come as soon as it has, as I didn't get to see the main reservoir. Mm-hmm. And in that one, the shortage and the difference in water supply is really, really drastic and is really noticeable. And in some of the footage and pictures that they've shown of that, you can really see the severity of the issue.
How are you preparing for this new reality, maybe short term, maybe longer term?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just trying to cut back on water usage. Luckily, I wouldn't think I have an above average water use, but, you know, I'm happy to abide and have fewer showers. I don't know, use less water to cook, reduce my shower time, that sort of stuff. Those seem to be the things that at home one can try and do to play a part, and they're feasible. I don't think they're really going to derail my own personal life. So I'm happy to try and abide by those. Hopefully the sooner the city collectively can try and take heed of these measures, the sooner the city will be able to go back to some degree of normality in terms of their water supply.
Inigo, thank you for your time.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
That was freelance journalist Inigo Alexander in Bogota. The first person to study giraffes in the wild was Anne Innes Dagg, a Canadian zoologist who went to South Africa when she was 23 to study the animals that had fascinated her since she was a child. Before her trip, she had discovered that there were no books about giraffes, so she decided to write one herself. And in 1956, for 9 hours a day over the course of 8 months, she observed giraffes from inside her car and then published a groundbreaking article entitled The Behavior of the Giraffe. But despite her remarkable research and experience, the world of zoology was apparently not ready for a woman to be made a tenured professor. For decades, Ms. Innes Dagg was largely overlooked and unrecognized for her achievements, until 2014, when the CBC broadcast a radio documentary about her work, which inspired the 2018 documentary, The Woman Who Loves Giraffes. Here is Anna Innes Dagg talking to the CBC in 2018.
I couldn't believe it, really, because I had a list of articles I'd written and maybe 10 books, and I was being told that I wasn't worthy to be a professor. I just thought that was terrible. I had to leave the university. I could have stayed one more year, but I thought if these idiots carry on like this, there's no point. Well, I didn't stop working, and what I really reverted to was working for women and pointing out all the awful things that were being done, and for everyone, not just me. I shouldn't just think of myself. So I got to work with other women, and we had things published in articles, and I worked really hard to try and get things better for women.
Anne Innes Dagg talking to the CBC in 2018. Ms. Innes Dagg died on April 1st at the age of 91. Alison Reed is the director of The Woman Who Loves Giraffes. We reached her in Hamilton.
Alison, that clip alone tells us a lot about who Anne Innes Dagg was. When you hear that clip now, where does it take you? What does it remind you of?
Well, you're right. That's just pure Anne. I mean, she had such a spirit, such a determination. She was so humble, so passionate about what she did, and you know, she was really incensed by what happened to her and what was happening to the other women who had PhDs around the time that she was trying to get a tenured professorship. So she fought very hard when she was denied tenure, as she alludes to in the comments she just made. She was uber qualified. She had written groundbreaking scientific journals that were published around the world. I mean, she had done groundbreaking work, and her teaching was well respected. Like, she ticked all the boxes, mm-hmm. yet she was denied tenure. She had an incredible determination.
You know, the coverage of her passing notably points out that she was out there doing this work with giraffes before Jane Goodall, before Dianne Fossey. We have another clip when she's speaking about that when people, speak about her coming before Jane Goodall and Dianne Fossey. Let's listen to that now.
Actually, I went before the two of them, so I laugh when people are saying, oh, well, they did the first work, and that's not true. It makes me laugh now. It always was ridiculous, really.
Yeah, there's, you know, she laughs about it, but you can tell just in that moment even that it stung at that time. What did she tell you about going back to the University of Guelph, the very same university that had denied her tenure when you went for the screening of your film?
Well, that was one of the moments that really sticks out in my head. But as I listen to that clip, I have to tell you a funny story. So, you know, people as a shorthand refer to Anne as the Jane Goodall of giraffes. And we had a screening of the film that our MP, and he introduced Jane as the Ann Dagg of chimpanzees. So I think he got it right.
Did the women ever, you know, get together or?
Yes. So, well, it was incredible because, of course, Anne was an avid reader, and she had read Jane's books, and Anne got a private meeting with her. And what's funny is that, you know, Jane sort of followed some of the same path that Anne traveled on her travels. And in one of Jane's books, she writes about, you know, I think she had a relationship with a certain guy on a ship that went from up the coast of Africa. Mm-hmm. And Anne was on that same ship earlier and had been hit on by the same guy. So they had a chuckle about that, I think.
How could you not? That's a pretty That's a pretty great story. I wonder what he's up to now.
Yeah.
He's probably still hitting on very intelligent women on the ship.
To Guelph, sorry, I didn't answer that question. I thought it was very courageous and good that the current provost decided to screen our film there. They were willing to acknowledge that, you know, things that shouldn't have gone on went on, but that things had changed. So it was very powerful to watch the film in that environment. There was one woman who was watching who was a student of biology in the 70s, and she stood up afterwards and she said, I feel so ripped off. You know, I was a student here, and I know that if Anne was my professor, I would have been able to do more because I went to Africa, but there were certain things that I couldn't accomplish. And I just know that if she was my professor, I could have accomplished so much more. So you have this situation where not only did Anne, you know, lose a lot of her dream and her potential to give the research that she would have done to the planet, but, you know, students lost out. I mean, the provost of the University of Guelph said, you know, we lost out not having Anne as part of our university. So I think there were multiple levels of disappointment. Yeah. But you know, the acknowledgement that went on and that things are changing and getting better and everyone's more cognizant of it is speaks volumes.
You gave me goosebumps as you recounted what that student said. Just her passion comes out in your voice as well. When was the last time you saw Anne?
Well, I saw her take her last breath.
Oh.
Yeah. So Mary and I were there with her, and Mary, her daughter, and I were with her when she took her last breath. Yeah, she went peacefully.
That says a lot about how close your relationship was, too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as I said, I met Anne. The first time I filmed Anne was in 2014. So she was 80 or 81 then. And, you know, she was 91 when she passed away. And, you know, you have this impression that once you reach 80, your life's probably, you know, not much more is going to happen. But that last decade of Anne's life was so full of richness. I mean, I spent 6 years making the film. We went to, you know, Kenya, South Africa, Texas, Chicago, you know, over Canada as well. So it was quite a ride making the film and then releasing the film and seeing how much Anne's story resonated with people all over the world and traveling with it. And then, you know, of course, Anne, you know, she was family to me. And, it's hard to lose her.
Allison, I'm very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
But, thank you.
Yeah,
you're generous to share your memories.
Yeah. But the good thing is I don't think she had a single regret. Like, every time we went to Africa, and we went several times, I mean, it was always a bit of a struggle to get, medical coverage for her because of her age. And she would always say, well, if I die in Africa, I'll die happy. Like, she was not afraid of death, I don't think. I think she died, you know, without any regrets. And, you know, she lived a really full life.
And her daughter is going to spread her ashes on giraffe breeding grounds in South Africa. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, they had a trip planned to South Africa this summer anyway. Anne was going to go. So I think Mary's chosen to take that trip and take it with Anne's ashes. So I think that's really moving. I hope I get to go with them.
Alison, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Alison Reed is the director of The Woman Who Loves Giraffes and a close friend of the late Anne Innes Dagg, who died on April 1st at the age of 91. We reached Ms. Reed in Hamilton, Ontario. And you can find where you can watch their documentary at thewomanwholovesgiraffes.com. Impersonating a police officer is a serious offense, but as far as I know, there's no charge for impersonating a police car, which is good news for an unnamed British bird. That's the sound of a bird in Bicester, England, whose impression of local police car sirens was reportedly so accurate that it had Thames Valley officers, quote, a little bit confused, unquote. Inspector Simon Hills told the BBC, "We repair a lot of police cars here. I thought it was maybe one that was defective and the battery was starting to go flat." Sounds more like Inspector Simon Cowell to me. That bird is pitch perfect. Anyway, the force reports that, after an investigation, it was determined that the male blackbird had spent hours patiently observing the cars in order to replicate their noise. And while he did initially have them fooled, they have resisted the temptation to make the blackbird a jailbird and are instead sharing his siren song. Here it is once more, our sound of the day. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.